certificate of the electoral vote of the state of California seems to be regular and form and authentic, and it appears therefrom that John F. Kerry of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts received 55 votes for president, and John Edwards of the state of North Carolina received 55 votes for vice president.
Mr. President, the certificate of the electoral vote of the state of Colorado seems to be regular, informed, and authentic, and appears therefrom that George W. Bush of the state of Texas received 9 votes for president, and Dick Cheney of the state of Wyoming received 9 votes for vice president.
Mr. President, the certificate of the electoral vote of the great state of Connecticut seems to be regular in form and authentic. It appears therefrom that John F. Kerry of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts received 7 votes for president, and John Edwards of the state of North Carolina received 7 votes for vice president.
Mr. President, the certificate of the electoral vote of the state of Delaware seems to be regular in form and authentic, and it appears therefrom that John F. Kerry of the Commonwealth...
Mr. Fool, this is Tracy James from Slave Revolt, out of Oakland, California, and it seems to me that your electoral college voting system is an inauthentic and inviolate charade, and the only form of the true human justice will be forged by the human-made will and the physical intellectual firepower of the masses. So the planet can inherit humans that realize they are a small part of this vast bio-ecosphere and will live responsibly and in harmony with the planet and its other living forms. But first, we gotta pick up the gun to dispose of the imperial planetary capitalist viral invaders. Yes, it does come down, it seems, to the ballot or the bullet. Get the hell out of here, you raggedy Democrats and Republicans. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LHUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, and also check out the Slave Revolt blog, this Google web, the Slave Revolt Radio, and check out the Pirate Network, my brother Rohan, the Minister of Slave Revolt Intergalactic Web Web Insurgency Space. You know what time it is. Tonight we're going to shoot our way right into how this is what they think of you, liberals, meaning an analysis beyond the shadow of the Democratic National Convention strategists on C-SPAN. All that and a hell of a lot more on You Know Where.
Budida, 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 budoodoo, be dee dee dee, boo dee boo dee, boo boo boo.
What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm going to be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and featherings, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Street you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you copped, the careers you stopped. All these are suits. Specific litigation as represent we, be like we, for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da. We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black belt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time is funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wheels. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that. Dee-dee-da, doo-doo. Bap, 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 doo, doo, doo. All that you got to give up. Autonomy and reparations to the Chicanos and the Native Americans whose soul you ripped out with their land. Give self-determination, regional autonomy. That's what my we is asking, and they're going to do the same when they demand it like us again in their own exploited name. Yeah, the education, that's right. 200 years. We want a central stash, a central bank with democratically elected trustees and a board elected by us all to map out from the referendum we set up what we want to spend it on to build that Malcolm sense self-determination as self-reliance and self-respect and self-defense. The will of what the good Dr. Du Bois beat on, true self-consciousness, simply the psychology of freedom. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, be-dee-da, boo-dee-da, that, ba ba ba, boo-dee, boo-dee, boo, boo, boo. Then we can talk about being American. Then we can listen without the undercurrent of desire to first set your ass on fire. We will only talk of voluntary unity of autonomy as vective arms of self-determination if there is democracy in you. That is where it will be shown. This is the only way we as Americans. This is the only truth that can be told. Otherwise, there is no future between us but war, and we is rather lovers and singers and dancers and poets and drummers and actors and runners and elegant heartbeats of the sun's flame. But we is also at the end of our silence and sit down. We is at the end of being under your ignorant smell, your intentional hell. Either give us our lives or plan to forfeit your own.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
And no way to measure what the amount of energy that
sources.
You know what time it is. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to deal with is the Democratic National Strategic Convention is already taking place, where the Democratic strategists for the Democratic Party are outlining where they need to go. You know, you know, as the stench from the rotting corpse called the Democratic Party continues to inflame the nostrils and lungs with its toxic odor, and deadly odor for that matter, those who are a part of this rotting corpse, like the Democratic National Strategists, are trying to, like Dr. Frankenstein, to bring back to life this rotting corpse. The other day on C-SPAN, they were on there with a lot of their top guns, from Donna Brazile all the way down the long, dreary line, with various people talking about what they need to do next to get things back into order for the Democratic Party and their constituents. And what they mean by order makes it clear to all of you liberals and pacifists and what else do you guys call yourselves? Progressives, that this is what they think of you. This is what they think about you. We're about to explore forthrightly, in their own words, what they think about y'all Democrats who pulled the lever for them. So first off, you have one of the panelists talking about some of the problems that Democrats are facing today. So let's see what they have to say are some of the problems, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
You were on the front lines. One of the things I didn't mention was your role at America's Coming Together, one of the leading Democratic 527. You're on the front lines, turnout machine, and one of the things that goes out is, you know, in one way, ACT won the 2000 election this year, but it wasn't the 2000 election. I mean, they fixed all the 2000 problems, but not. What did you see on the front lines that showed why this election got close but then didn't?
Well, mechanically, I think everybody involved in our side did a fine job. I mean, we didn't have a turnout problem in the election. We had a message problem, a party image problem at the end of the day. I mean, all these things are true. As a party, we are too coastal, we are too urban, we're too secular. We are, most of all, too dovish, and that's what's going on. I mean, everybody wants to find a single answer to all of this, and obviously values have a lot to do with it. The things Congressman Carson's written about are interesting and clever and absolutely true, and that informs the entire conversation. And Harrison, of course, is right that presidential voting particularly is very, very personal, very much about the candidates, less about issues. There's a lot of good things happening out there, too. I mean, it's easy to assume, I do at least, that the leading edge of a party's health is found at the state and local level. I think, you know, we did better in state elections. We netted, 40-some new Senate House members. We netted plus 9 or 10 new state Senate members. We took over a net of 3 or 4 new chambers. We did very well in governor's races. The easy explanation, I think it's true, that we're doing better at that level is they're able to escape the negative stereotypes of the Democratic Party much more easily. But first and foremost, because state House candidates aren't grappling with issues of terrorism and war, and that's where we're getting killed. At the end of the day, the biggest structural problem for us is a party on the federal level, in Congress and with the presidential campaigns. The public simply doesn't trust us to keep them safe. When that is first and foremost in their mind, in a Cold War environment or a neo-Cold War environment like now, we have serious problems. We put up a war hero, but he was more than just a resume. He is a big man who takes up a lot of room. He drew his leadership and strength and experience, and it still wasn't quite enough. And he still was dragged down by enduring and, to a large part, true set of negative stereotypes about the party. Until we can fix that and convince Americans that we're not the party only of Michael Moore, that we are a party determined and willing and strong enough and brave enough to keep them safe, we're going to keep getting, you know, these results on the national level.
So there you have it. You know, he says, first off, that we had a problem, a message problem. But then he goes into how they're seen as being too urban, too secular, too dovish. In other words, too urban meaning too black, too secular. You know, they're not bending their knees enough and pretending that they have some kind of connection with some invisible man. And too dovish means they need to present themselves being more militaristic. Now, they're already acting as militaristic as the Raggedy Republicans. But he looks at these things as things that need to be dealt with. In essence, he's following this, a similar type of, without saying it, Southern Strategist program that the, and advocating it, that the Raggedy Republicans had done decades earlier. You know, all of this, too urban and, you know, need to be more militaristic and, image-wise and things of that nature. That's all of that is. That's part of the Southern Strategist, you know. Keep the Negroes away. Diss the Negroes, like Crime Bill Clinton did to Sister Soldier and old raggedy beat down Negro Jesse Jackson. That's the way he's playing it. Then he goes into that our problem is on the federal level. The public doesn't believe that the Democrats can keep them safe. Now, what is he talking about? He's talking about being more, presenting more of a John Wayne militaristic image and, you know, whole persona once again. Now, in the real world, what Boy George and them are doing is not keeping people in this country more safe or the world safer. It's actually pushing the globe down the hill into the abyss. They're making planetary life more and more in a crisis mode. So when this clown talks about imagery, he's not talking about reality on the ground. He's talking about the whole persona thing. The fact that both of these imperialist parties are plunging the world into more and more chaos doesn't bother him at all, because he knows that that's all part of the order. But they're trying to get elected. So, well, what he's crying about is that they don't have the image of the party of the Republicans in that same ruthless mode. So this shows how sick this type of stuff is. And then he goes in and throws in this comment about, you know, there's some stereotypes about us. And some of them are true negative stereotypes. And then he, you know, starts naming things. And the one name that comes up is Michael Moore. Now, see here, Moore poured himself out for the Democratic Party. Came back aboard ship like a beaten, choked, half-drowned rat. And how do they respond to him after it's all said and done? As a problem child, you know, because now his image is used by the Republicans to galvanize their base. Now, the fact that he went out and did work and helped galvanize the base for the Democrats doesn't even matter to them, you know, because they didn't win. At least, you know, actually Kerry may have won, actually just going by the raggedy votes. But since the dude punked out, you know, to maintain social order, he didn't win. This shows you how sick and cynical these guys are when they're talking amongst themselves. And it shows, truly, this is what they really think about you. I'm talking about the fools who have the nerve or the lack of respect and integrity to vote for.
Well, you know what? First of all, the Democratic Party is a political machinery, is what it comes down to, for the election of its candidates. Yes, it is an imperialist, a capitalist party. But recently, you know, they have been, ever since the emergence of this Democratic Leadership Conference, Council rather, they have consciously taken, well, accelerated the tendency to capitulate on anything that they may have once stood for, that may have had some principle involved in it. Following these most recent electoral disasters for them, because remember, they lost the House, the Senate, and the presidency. Establishment Democrats have concluded that the Democratic Party lost because it was overly faithful to the principles of the Democratic rank and file, the Democratic Party's rank and file. In order to rectify this error, former Congressman Tim Romer has been recruited to oppose Howard Dean for the Democratic National Committee chairmanship. They already went through that. You see? They did not want Howard.
In many ways, they're also talking about perception, because if you look at the Democratic Party and its actions over the last 8 years when prime Bill Clinton was president, they were as militaristic, as vulturistic, as imperialistic, and as genocidalistic as, you know, the next regime. You know, it was crime Bill Clinton that evaporated 1 million people during his whole sanctions program. Didn't blink an eye. Then did the Lindy hop over to Texas, saw them cats in Waco, whack, whack, smacked them out. He was getting this groove on.
Americans.
He was getting this groove on all over the place. So a lot of this type of stuff is perception and, you know, kind of blame game and so on and so forth.
But they have recently decided that to rectify this error of being too associated with liberal causes or anything of principle that's good for the people, that and Howard Dean, as far as I'm concerned, is not necessarily that. But you're right. It's an image thing. Well, what they did was they want to moderate their stance on reproductive rights. Specifically, Romer is stressing attracting socially conservative voters by having the Democrats support the criminalization of late-term abortions. That's what they're trying to do right now. And you know what? It's going to lead to what it's been leading to. Every time they try to open the gates to the right wing, they just lose support. The right wing don't come over to them.
And also, you know, this type of thing has been going on before. As anyone who's listened to my commentary, The War on Women's Reproduction Freedoms, the links are clear. It's clear that under the Democratic administrations as well as the Republicans, they never really went after and have never really gone after these abortion bombing terrorists. They have a whole network. A lot of this stuff is out front that these little terrorists have been doing, you know, bombing up clinics, targeting doctors, et cetera, et cetera. Crime Bill Clinton, during his administration, gave them a pass, too. He never came out and did anything forthright, you know, and got the guards. I'm not saying I expected it. But what I'm saying is that a lot of these regressions that you're seeing and the role that the Democratic Party is playing is in response to the fact that the working class is in such a reverse mode at this time, and that the global geopolitical politics at this particular time has the imperialist class seizing on the world working class. So they're, of course, going to kind of be more than willing to allow the working class that they pretend that they represent get their rights soaked up from under their eyes, because they're really down with that ruling class. So they've never really stood for those interests in the first place. And many times, many of these things that they've helped kind of quote-unquote orchestrate in has more to do with being a buffer on a seizing working class during a particular period than it had to do with them really siding with the masses of working class people. But next, you know, they have this little former congressman, Brad Carson, out of Oklahoma. And he's going to talk about the face of the Democratic Party now and some of its particular role. So let's see what Brad Carson has to say. He just lost, so now he's on the outs. Which he's hella bitter about, too. And you'll find out against, too. Check it out.
Harrison, if you went into Dayton, Ohio right now and asked a focus group of independent or, you know, mush, squishy R's or squishy D's and said, who is the face of the Democratic Party right now? Who is the face of the Democratic Party? And they had to pick one person. Who would they pick?
Well, probably Bill Clinton.
Brad Carson, what about in Oklahoma?
Hillary Clinton.
Donna, what would your guess be?
Bill Clinton.
Sure.
I don't know that we've got a face. I mean, I think a lot of people come out of this thing saying, you know, we spent a lot of money on John Kerry and he had resources. I think this party's looking for a face. I mean, it might be the Clintons at some level, but I'm not sure the public has any feel for what our face looks like.
Jim?
I would guess it's the Clintons collectively.
All right, which then leads to the next question. What should the role of the Clintons be in the party? Are the Clintons plus, a minus? Obviously, some could argue they're both. Let me start with Congressman Carson. What should the role of the Clintons be in the party, and both Bill Clinton and then Senator Clinton?
Well, I said Hillary Clinton because in the end, the race turned for us when there were multi-million dollar expenditures saying a vote for Brad Carson is a vote for Hillary Clinton and Ted Kennedy, who I would also say, and wasn't mentioned, are important faces of the Democratic Party. And that's what turned the race for us. And we have several folks in the room who worked on our campaign. We travel around. People say, you know, I think you'd be a much better senator than Tom Coburn would be. But you're going to deliver the Senate to the hands of Ted Kennedy and Hillary Clinton. And we can't have that happen. And so I think, you know, it speaks to that brand problem. The role of the Clintons, I don't know. I can't say. I think we would be wise to try to turn to people who are less polarizing in places like the Oklahomas and the southern states like Louisiana. You know, polarizing maybe for the right reasons, depending upon one's politics, but far too polarizing to be the kind of figure we need to bridge these tremendous divides that have developed over the last 15 years.
So you see what's going on. This is pure by image stuff. You know, the so-called polarizing image that Clinton has basically has been manufactured. If you take it within the concept of bourgeois politics, it's been manufactured in part by the whole corporate media system. You know, Rush, Bill O'Reilly, all of those kooks on the right who, you know, constantly badgered Clinton for, you know, every little move he made. But, you know, within that same context, it can be argued from the whole bourgeois standpoint and even international standpoint of people believing in the presidency and and all that type of stuff, that Boy George has been just as quote-unquote polarizing. But Boy George does not have that same image because of how the corporate media structure is set up. And basically, you know, the fact that you have the right sieging hard in their radio shows constantly, they have all of their network hookups and stuff like that, constantly putting out that whole echo chamber and creating and helping guide and push the masses of working class people to be more belligerent and to look at things in a more imagery prone way, as opposed to a class way. So you have this type of madness going on, and it has helped set up a situation for the Republicans at this particular time to kind of seize the time in this kind of, you know, bourgeois politics type stuff. But in the real world, the ruling class, the classes that all of them serve, the class that Barbara Boxer serves, the class that Barbara Lee serves, the class that O'Reilly serves, the Republicans, Democrats, etc., they're the ones who are polarizing the world with, of course, their classic stance on everything for them, nothing for us. But see, these guys, since they're not coming at it from a class combative way, they're looking at it in this kind of democratic strategist way of how they can get their imperialists in. It's almost like a game to them. And who ends up doing the bulk of the suffering? The masses of people.
I thought it was quite interesting that the young man would use the term Hillary Clinton and, oh man, old crime Bill Clinton are too polarizing. Now, after a while, you know, you have to recognize that this loses all real meaning. Does he mean that the fact that old Bill, that somebody, you know, polishes little stuff off is morally repugnant to some, you know, truly religious people? Is that what he mean? No. But what does he mean? What issue is he speaking about? In fact, the same person may be a unifier on one issue and polarizing on another. But if he wants to suggest that just the very fact that they exist or come into a room polarizes the room, along what axis? In fact, even an election is supposed to carry out some polarization, because everybody is not going to vote for a single candidate. So there has to be some axis upon which you polarize the situation and you act as a magnet of votes towards you. They have become so apolitical themselves that they talk this madness and maybe even believe it.
Well, I mean, it's also because they kind of filter their kind of whole analysis in a similar way that the corporate media through the CNN and all of those networks do, you know, where they're doing these voting polls and all of that type of stuff as elections are coming around. And then they do you feel that George Bush is a strong, morally inclined person? And the way things are presented in a very droned out society at this particular time, what a lot of this stuff basically means is that Boy George is considered by many people a principled person because he doesn't vacillate on his position. He believed that Saddam, apparently he believed it, had weapons of mass destruction, and he didn't falter from it. He believes an invisible man in the sky, and by God, every day you can go into the Oval Office, look, where is he? Then look behind the desk. There he is on his knees. In other words, this is all
Bush.
Yeah, Bush. This is all this whole packaging thing. And since there is not really the class aspect taken into consideration by the Democratic Party, because they're not a class combative party. they're not there to really fight the ruling class.
They are the ruling class.
They are there basically to get their particular candidates elected. So a lot and we now live in a society where talking about class related issues is considered by itself polarizing. So anytime you bring up issues about unions, support of unions, support of teachers, watching the role and actions of the police, watching the way the meat industry is being able to allow more and more garbage into the food system, you know, chemicals in it and poor meat inspection and all of that, which of course is regurgitated by the other side as being class combative because it's causing extra expenses on the corporation and, you know, on and on. So the Democratic Party, by and large, and their strategists want to stay away from those quote-unquote polarizing issues because of how it's framed in this particular gumped-up society. So if you don't have, if the masses of people don't have any form of representation, you know, in power, you know, their own fighting bloc in power, then this is in part how things become deregulated down intellectually and everything else. But next, Congressman Carson talks about the gay vote and the values issues during his campaign and how it affected his campaign. So let's check out what this Democrat has to say about this as he makes it more clear about what they think about y'all voters for the Democratic Party. Check it out.
Congressman, you were telling me something before about, we were talking about the gay marriage issue in Oklahoma, and you were saying at one point, you know, how you were speaking about gay marriage, that at one point it was actually alienating gay voters, and you lost a sliver of voters who voted against you or angry. And this whole values thing, and we know Democrats are trying to figure out, and there's some people just, you know, who think, well, they can solve the values thing by just, you know, gay bashing. How do you do this values thing without alienating groups on the left?
You know, I don't have an answer, and that's why I end up being the youngest ex-congressman in the country at 37. Because, you know, it's the dilemma you have in a close race. We knew the Senate race was going to be a very close one, or we hoped it would be. And the gay marriage initiative in Oklahoma passed with 76% of the vote. But of course, the gay and lesbian community was deeply upset by that. And deeply upset that a Democratic politician would be supportive of it, which I was. I voted for the ban when it came through the House. So, and many of them were defecting or threatening to defect to the third party candidate who was just kind of a placeholder for people who thought Coburn was certainly far too extreme but were angry at me for something. And so you would take a position like that where 76% of the people were voting for it, but I alienated 5 to 7% of the electorate by being for the ban. And so either way, I could alienate 75% of the electorate or 7% of the electorate, but I was going to be defeated either way in a close race. And that's a phenomenal challenge you have. And, you know, I think Peter Beinart in the New Republic that has just come out has a great essay about Democrats and defense issues. And he's right in that to say we have to change the grassroots. You know, we have to go out and change what the grassroots think about these kind of issues. And hopefully people with political maturity can understand how you put coalitions together that get you a long ways to where you want to go, but, you know, not always there. So I don't have an answer for you on that. And I think, you know, your questions about Hillary Clinton and things are such, it's not a matter of personality. Maybe if we had an extraordinarily charismatic figure, you could transcend these problems. And if John Kerry had won, I think it would have just papered over the problems rather than solve them. And that we have deep structural problems. You know, I think Larry Sabato, who of course is our host here along with you, Chuck, said it best, I think, in one of his appearances when, you know, I heard him saying it had such profound resonance to me that until the last member of the Vietnam generation dies, we're going to be fighting that battle over and over and over again. And
That's what I see in Congress. I see it in Oklahoma. We're fighting the 60s social struggles, both the domestic and international ones, over and over again. Oklahoma was clearly on one side of that divide, and they have come home to roost today. And until the last member of that generation dies and new people come in who aren't formed by those experiences, said the Democrats are on the side, one side of those changes that has a phenomenally organized and well-financed resistance to it. And we get beaten every election fighting those same battles. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's the country. It's the world. In the same way that the elections in the 1880s were still about the Civil War. You know, till the last generation formed by that tremendously tumultuous moment passes, then we live in its shadow. And we reap the whirlwind.
Now, are you listening to what this dude is saying? Basically, he's saying that you all got to die off. You know, those guys, y'all in the 60s generation, you all got to die off because you're a losing cause. Now, he's not talking about the values per se that were developed during the 60s. He's talking about the fact that the right has seized the time and has helped forge in a mentality that is anti many of the issues that were permeating around the 60s. You know, the whole anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the kind of, you know, freedom of speech type things, all of that. There's no tolerance for that right now. Now, he's not saying these are types of things we should try to insert back into a decadent society. No, he's saying there's nothing you can do about it. In other words, he's not down with fighting for those types of issues and stuff. He's not down for fighting for many of the principles that the civil rights movement stood for. He's not down with fighting for the anti-war type movements and stuff. He's not down with that. So those people and those traditions that type of stuff represents, they're a problem. And until y'all die off, the Democratic Party is in a bear trap. That's what he thinks about y'all. Then he talks about how he voted for the ban on gay marriage. And it was a tactical thing. It's clear that, because from what you get from what he said, you don't know if he believes in gay marriage or not. He, as a matter of fact, he may be gay himself for all you know. I'm serious about this. But he's basically, from a Democratic strategic standpoint, is saying, look, 76% of the people in Oklahoma were against the gay marriage thing, and 5 to 7% were for it, and a lot of them, of course, were Democratic type voters. So that polarized them. So many of them threatened and did defect to a third party. So either way, I would lose, you know, because if I voted for the Democratic, voted for the gay marriage, it would have polarized a larger proportion of the population. And when I voted for against it, it knocked away 5 to 7% of my own Democratic base. In other words, nothing that he said had anything to do with principle. It had nothing to do with human rights or anything like that. He's not concerned with that. He's a Democratic strategist.
Right.
And it all fits within the whole surging aspect of the reaction, the reactionary time that we're in. Now, many people who wonder how stuff could have happened like it did in Nazi Germany and stuff like that. Look, you don't need to fantasize about that now. You can see how people in parties I shouldn't say parties, but people and many issues that they may or may not hold close to them are easily corroded and finessed and so on and so forth as they try to navigate their way in and through a barbaric, draconian society and authoritarian system and stuff. So he talks about how the Democratic Party has deep structural problems. Now, he's not talking about these structural problems have anything to do with the foundation that they're based in. He's talking about the base and the way the base is perceived in the larger American landscape,
right,
and how its image is projected over the corporate media system and how they relate to that base without alienating some of the people that they're trying to bring in, you know, as a quote-unquote inclusive party. See, this is some sick stuff. He topped it off also with, we have to change what the grassroots thinks about these issues. In other words, the grassroots, i.e. the base, has to be compromised. Now, they're already compromised. If you listen to Norm Solomon and Chomsky and, you know, all these guys, they dreadedly compromise. But he's saying in this whole nother venue that they have to be even more pragmatic about their approach. What he basically means is not have any of the principles you stand for or even say you stand for. And do what is necessary, shut the hell up when it's necessary to help us get elected. Period. And prepare to die in the meantime.
And also let your daughter die. Because this is not, it's not only this thing.
Well, if they're preparing, that's everyone.
That's right. Not only are we talking about the gay marriage thing, but I think, for me personally, the question of women having an unconditional right to abortion is a much more important issue for me. And contrary to...
Well, he wasn't talking about that right
now. No,
there.
No, I'm talking about it.
There's many things.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of gays who are talking about, you know, this whole gay marriage thing. If you take what they were saying, I read this article about what a gay guy was saying, what they stood for, like in the 70s. Now them crying about trying to get married, that's actually a step back, because at one time they were talking about breaking the so-called nuclear family structure and challenging the nuclear family structure, and now they're talking about trying to be within the nuclear family structure. So even within the gay community, there's a lot of issues on that type of stuff.
But as I said before, former Congressman Tim Romer has been recruited, and they're trying to get him to push this moderate stance on reproductive rights. But contrary to popular myth, women who undergo third trimester abortions are not homicidal, you know, maniacs intent on killing their own fetuses. The procedures, this late term abortion stuff, is important because, and they're performed when unforeseen complications occur that endangers a woman's life. Invariably, the women have been planning to carry her pregnancy to term and is emotionally devastated that things have gone horribly wrong. Now, given that, these people don't care nothing about no women. The religious zealots do not really care about the embryos even. And here's proof. By their steadfast opposition to funding prenatal care programs. If you really cared about the children and the fetus becoming a child, you'd be for fun. They vote against it every time. So it's not this method, this triangulation or whatever the hell they call it, it's not new. And what it really shows in a really upfront and clear way is not only the necessity, but the very real possibility of the working people breaking off right now, a clean break with the Democrats, and forming a workers' party in their own name, with their own interests and their own programs.
It's beyond the issue of it not being new. A lot of these tactics and strategies by the ruling class and their servants are not all of that new. But when you have the working class contracting at that time, and basically disintegrating from any kind of class consciousness approach, and doing things like in California, where they see some, you know, roided out bum, you know, Hollywood actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, come to town, and then they suddenly just kind of get misty eye and think that he's going to be some kind of savior, like in some, you know, Hollywood movie and stuff. This is an indication of the lack of class consciousness that is going on within the masses at this particular time, and how eroded things are. Now, next, Harrison talks about how the party is perceived, and then Brad Carson also jumps in there with a little dialogue. Let's check out what they have to say, Big Goose.
Harrison, you obviously do this on a poll, on a statistical front, and see some of these things. What do you
think? Well, I think in many ways we've become a party of, it's seen as the party of contrivance, that's what I talk about the solution to 1994. I mean, I think in many ways Congressman Parson's a good example. He got hit on both sides on the gay rights issue, because the attack from the other side was, well, that's not what some of the people who are support gay rights think.
You should say what happened in that, because there's an interesting part about the campaign. I was for the ban and I voted for it, but there was an article in the Washington Blade that came out in the middle of a year ago, and they said, you know, trying to be mature, we should try to be supportive of people like Brad Carson who might be sympathetic to our agenda if elected to the Senate. Well, 527 ran about $600,000 of that Washington Blade article. Here's what the homosexuals say about Brad Carson. If elected, he will be sympathetic to our cause.
Right, I think my point to that is, this is where you were hurt by the party as opposed to how you had voted, is that people thought that, well, maybe he just voted that way because he wanted to pull the wool over our eyes. I mean, if you look at George Bush, at the end of the 2000 election, Laura Bush said something to the effect in the last 10 days of the campaign about the fact that she was pro-choice, just as her mother-in-law had done in 1988, and it clearly trying to signal that. Now, if someone on our side had done that, this year Bush showed some small equivocation on the issue of gay rights. At the very end of the campaign. If somebody on our side had done that, we would have been, voters would have said, oh, well, I don't believe he really thinks that. He's just saying that to win votes. And it's not that they are any more skillful at their contrivances than we are. It's just that when they say it, they aren't instantaneously presumed to be uttering a contrivance. I think people don't think we really believe what we say.
That's because you don't believe it.
You don't believe what you say. I mean, basically, if you go by some of the stuff he said, it's clear that he doesn't believe what he says. He goes into this stuff about Carson, once again, was the guy who got himself caught up within the Matrix game of the gay vote issue. Lost some of the vote from his base. He couldn't, basically, from his perception, vote for the gay vote thing, because 76% of the population in Oklahoma was against it. So, in other words, this wasn't a thing about principle for him. So, it's clear to see how contrived this individual was. The guy says that to Carson, that this is, goes into how you were hurt by the party instead of how you voted. And what he basically means by that is that the Democratic Party should have the same kind of propaganda machinery, that when you do things that are contradictory and hypocritical, the Republicans, that do have the machinery to propagandize and help gumpify down the voting population to basically just wash over the issue, because you have some other image that is so solidly erected that you're like Teflon. You know, it just doesn't stick to you. So that's basically what he's complaining about. Once again, this is nothing about any real principles and all of that, because their foundation of principles are rooted within the imperialist class. So he whines about it's not that the Republicans are any more skillful at their contrivances than us, and on and on and on. But he doesn't believe that people believe what we say. Now, if you go by just what he was saying, it's clear that his principles aren't based off of what they may or may not offer you. It's basically about what they have to strategically do to get elected. That's what this whole conference is about. This whole little strategic conference is how we can manipulate and present an image that becomes a definable image to the masses, so that when we say things, the image of us is going to be the thing that is going to stand up like a giant rock above anything else. So they don't even have to believe what we say, because we have a particular image. That's what he's talking about. And in essence, they don't have it from their perception at this time. So the fact that they are lying quite often, like the Republicans, that's the problem with the whole mechanism. This is just a real cynical game. And for anyone to try to think that they can play a role in pushing the Democrats to the center and all of that type of stuff. I mean,
you center.
Woo! You're playing a game of a form of contrivances that's basically out of this world.
In fact, you know, but there is an end game in sight, Trace. Because the more the Democrats pursue this strategy, the less they're going to have, in their own words and through their own actions, to offer any working class people. So, for instance, it's funny. This is funny. They, in Washington, D.C., they always putting up these statues. So some artist made a statue of a Democrat and a Republican and put it, of an elephant and a donkey, and put them in bridal clothes like they was going to be in a wedding and stuff. I thought that's funny, but the truth of the matter is they're not quite married, not this moment, and it's because they're competing. That's the only reason. They're two entities that are competing for the same seats. That's about the difference in them, to be honest. There's not much of a political difference. See, many Democrats have survived hitherto by promising just slightly more to working people than the Republicans, and working a skillful, if the Republicans win, the sky will fall. Well, you know, right now, that shit ain't working. That's not going to work. For all the obvious reasons, trade unionists, for instance, like to sit around and complain about Democrats. And that's not even very simple anymore. First, you have to figure out which Democratic Party you want to complain about. Is it the official Democratic Party? That is, you're talking about the National Democratic Committee? Well, actually, the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee, doesn't really do, you know, very much besides raise money. You understand? The Democratic Party itself is all broken up into different layers of bureaucracy. The program doesn't mean anything. It's totally unaccountable. You get elected, you basically do what you want. Nobody says, when's the last time they kicked the Democratic mayor or governor out of office because he didn't represent the principles of the Democrats?
Well, for me, you know, it's not so much just about the Democrats putting themselves in a box, you know. In other words, as they keep compromising themselves, there's less room for them to move. Because for me, it's really what the masses of people are doing or not doing. Because the Democratic Party and the Republican Party can keep bounding themselves up in contradiction all day. But unless the masses of class-conscious people are in motion, then they'll always have room to maneuver and stuff. So to wait for the Democratic Party to peter out or implode is basically like dancing on quicksand yourself. We have to get into motion.
Yeah.
It's not so much about, you know, what the Democratic Party is doing or not doing or what direction, unless you're just some kind of little petty bourgeois type thing, you know, waiting for them to go off the cliff. When the masses of us sharpen our grip, pistol grip on what the hell is going on, then there's some light within the abyss. Now, next, the panel talks about how do you tell the left to give the Democrats and the Democratic runners a pass on some issues. So let's check out what these guys got to say. Dig this.
Jim, how does you deal with some of the base constituents you did at ACT? How does the Republicans successfully are able to sometimes use code words or just language? They don't have to specifically touch on certain issues to or their national candidate doesn't. Where with Democrats, the left, you know, they want to, you know, they want to hear to make sure they hear the word abortion. They want to hear certain words to make sure that they know that they stand correct on certain issues. How does the left, how do you tell the left to, you know, give a candidate a pass?
Well, I think actually the progressive community, particularly, but the nominating process is very difficult for all of us. I mean, all 7, 8, 9, whatever we're running, you saw us. We did it relentlessly. All the candidates had to go up on stage and outpander one another, and absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And it's not that the same events don't seem to happen on the Republican side. They certainly have in other cycles. Seems to me in 2000, Bush was anointed so early he was able to spare himself some of the worst type of panderings. But it seems to me absolutely true that right now, for whatever reasons, it's an observation, not an objection, we are more defined by the fringe elements of our party than the Republicans have been. Now, there's every happy indication that the wackos are going to be running the asylum here in D.C. I mean, the last month has been terrifically bad for George Bush. I mean, when he's getting rolled on the Hill by, you know, pipsqueaks like Duncan Hunter and Jim Sensenbrenner, that is a fantastic start for us. And it's not clear to me that threatening phone calls or pleading phone calls from Karl Rove are going to fix the problem for the next 4 years. This is all good stuff for us. But for the last several years, for the last 5 years at least, the Republican right has been disciplined, they've been quiet, and they've managed to do their business, you know, out of plain sight.
Now, once again, what this guy is basically talking about is the art of deception and cold words, because they start off with how the Republicans basically use code words to relate to their constituents that they're down with the cause, but the left, as they call it, in other words, the little progressives and, you know, pacifists and all of that, they want to hear the word. So in other words, since the progressives are a little bit more skeptical of the Democratic Party, they want to hear their candidates actually say they're going to do this or that. And that has created a problem because these issues are polarizing. He wrapped it up by basically saying right now the Democrats are more defined by the fringe elements of the party. Now, who is he talking about? He's talking about teachers' unions, you know, the anti-war activists, the anti-abortion, the pro-abortion activists. What they basically want is just a sterile, God-fearing population, this gumpified down that presents this kind of Leave It to Beaver image, so that they can say, look, we represent the quote-unquote sterile, hocus-pocus, non-reality values that the Republicans do. So once again, this is not about true decency or anything of that nature. It's all about imagery and how to get elected within this barbaric system in society.
And how to get elected, according to these Democratic Party strategists, is not to go out and do good deeds in the community or become a part of the struggles that go on in the community. Oh, hell no. What they want to do is gauge people's attitudes, their feelings, and their emotions, and their thoughts. That is, they want to poll them. The pollsters, the consultants, and strategists thus comprise the real meat of the Democratic Party. These are the folks who write the questions, take the polls, spin the results, devise the party strategy and positions, set up and run campaigns, and then turn in a big bill for big bucks. Without this section of the Democratic Party, literally nothing would happen. This is also the slice of the Democratic Party that is run exclusively by very wealthy folks who all have good jobs. See, they're giving themselves a good job. They got a nice home, and they all got health care. Listen, but when you talk about the progressives, see, it's a little different, because the progressives, so-called, end up being the section of the Democratic Party that still speaks up for the working people. Well, sort of, you know. I tell you, you attend their two-day conferences, and some of these folks in Washington, you could be amazed. First, you'd be shocked just how small and marginalized this section has become. Gone are the days when labor-friendly guys like Ted Kennedy and Walter Mondale led an actual critical mass of Democrats. Apparently, in order to survive, the self-styled so-called progressives within the Democratic Party have expanded this definition of progressive to include just about anyone. That anyone included is now a retired ice cream tycoon who regularly calls the cops when my union attempts to leaflet the workers of his Vermont factories. They talk about Jerry and them, you know? As far as I could tell, the Democratic National Council just really is the group that's running the Democrats right now. And that's where that triangulation and all this polls and stuff. This is a machinery to get their candidates elected, period. And it's been that for so long that people like the people you're listening to now, they don't even know what the issues are, really, or care. They only care about how they impact on the voters. How many votes will it get?
The issues aren't really the issue from a, you know, human standpoint. Now, while these Democratic strategists are wondering what has happened to their party, this episode was taking place. Check it out.
Speech. The clerk will report the objection made in the joint session.
We, a member of the House of Representatives and a United States Senator, object to the counting of the electoral votes of the state of Ohio on the ground that they are not, under all of the known circumstances, regularly given. Signed, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, State of Ohio, Barbara Boxer, State of California.
The chair will endeavor to alternate recognition between members speaking in support of the objection and members speaking in opposition to the objection. The chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Ohio, Mrs. Jones, for 5 minutes.
Mr. Speaker, and ladies and gentlemen, I, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, a representative from the state of Ohio, and Senator Barbara Boxer, a senator from California, have objected to the counting of the electoral votes of the state of Ohio on the ground that they were not, under all the known circumstances, regularly given. I thank God that I have a senator for joining me in this objection, and I appreciate Senator Boxer's willingness to listen to the plight of hundreds and even thousands of Ohio voters that for a variety of reasons were denied the right to vote. Unfortunately, objecting to the electoral vote from Ohio is the only immediate avenue to bring these issues to light. While some have called our cause foolish, I can assure you that my parents, Mary and Andrew Tubbs, did not raise any fools. They raised a lawyer. They raised a former judge. They raised a prosecutor. And thank God they lived to see me to serve as a member of the House of Representatives. I am duty bound to follow the law and apply to the law to the facts as I find them. And it is on behalf of those millions of Americans who believe in and value our democratic process and the right to vote that I put forth this objection today. If they are willing to stand at polls for countless hours in the rain, as many did in Ohio, then I should surely stand up for them here in the halls of Congress. This objection does not have at its root the hope or even the hint of overturning the victory of the president, but it is a necessary, timely, and appropriate opportunity to review and remedy the most precious process in our democracy. I raise this objection neither to put the nation in the turmoil of a proposed overturn election, nor to provide cannon fodder or partisan demagoguery for my fellow members of Congress. I raise this objection because I am convinced that we as a body must conduct a formal and legitimate debate about election irregularities. I raise this objection to debate the process and protect the integrity of the true will of the people. Again, I thank Senator Boxer. There are serious allegations in two lawsuits pending in Ohio that debate the constitutionality of the denial of provisional ballots to voters.
Now, this shows you how compromised these clowns are. You know, she says that my parents didn't raise a fool, but she thinks that we are. Because she goes into this stuff about why she raised this objection. But then she says that this objection to what happened in Ohio does not have any hope or hint of overturning the election. Well, then what the hell are you raising it for? It's all a facade. It's all basically to smooth off some of the rough edges of these little weak progressives and Democratic voting, beat down human beings. Because they're not really trying to win anything. They're not really trying to expose anything. They didn't try to basically catch the Republicans off guard. They let them know beforehand that they were going to, do this objection thing. So the Republicans were, in many ways, more prepared with their propaganda than they were. So they didn't object like into what took place in Florida, what took place in New Mexico. They didn't get cats like Greg Palast and people who had been following this stuff for 4 years and who had a background in what happened in Florida, written stuff about it. Actually was the one who broke the story about what originally happened in Florida in 2000, predicted and said that everything was set in place for a theft of this election again in 2004. See, the Democrats, they weren't coming from a full frontal assault to actually challenge this thing. Kerry didn't even show up. He didn't even bother with it. He's off, fishing somewhere. This shows you how cynical this whole thing is. And in many ways, this is probably what many of these Democratic strategists that you heard beforehand tells them to do. That if the Democrats really push this issue, the way the whole corporate media structure is and the way people are in place within the little networks like Rush Limbaugh and O'Reilly and all of these kooks, this will be a polarizing issue. So we as Democrats want to stay away from these polarizing issues. Right. So basically they neuter themselves from even standing up for their own particular self-interest of getting people elected into office that they want. Now, if they can't even halfway put up a decent fight for getting their own people elected, when it's clear that there was a lot of shenanigans going on, then how in the hell do you think they're going to or have any real interest in standing up for your rights?
Thank you.
I mean, this is all a sham. You're being bamboozled. And continue to follow around and along with this charade is beyond pathetic at this point. it's been beyond pathetic before, but now, I mean, this is suicidal stuff.
Yeah.
This is some sick, corrosive stuff. You just heard her up there.
In fact, Tracy, I listened to the whole preceding thing that they played on Pacifica. And, well, to be perfectly blunt, I was not that impressed just on at the face of it. And I think your analysis makes some sense that this was not a serious onslaught against undemocratic procedure, but a show, a minstrel show at that, to just throw a little sop to their so-called progressive Democrats and say, see, we tried, but did they really? Most of the Democrats in the Congress did not even vote along with the people that raised this. Only 30 Democrats voted with her. So they don't even believe it their damn self. Look,
and not interested in it.
No.
They're more concerned about preserving
the PACs.
And preserving the false integrity of the system.
Yeah.
Than to really exposing how corrosive the system is.
Yeah, I want to just take a minute and show how bad this can get and what, you know, and how this stuff really plays itself out with the Democrats. So the Democrats are quite willing to, and long ago showed their willingness to betray black people. I mean, that was one of the first things they did. They had no problem. You know, we are, blacks have long been the most reliable constituency of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party has indeed repaid that loyalty with undisguised contempt. Undisguised. You know, this unrequited love we seem to have. Now, I worked with the Million Worker March, and one thing I noticed, and I had to notice, I couldn't, is how hostile the trade union bureaucrats who are Democrats were towards the march. And I never made the connection, but dig this. We learned this later at a meeting that in a place called Hyannisport, Massachusetts, during the Democratic Party National Convention, right, there was a meeting involving Senator Edward Kennedy, get this, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, Teamsters President Jim Hoffa, I thought they didn't get along, SEIU President Andrew Stern, President James Spinoza of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen Union, and guess what they were talking about, Trey? They were talking about the Million Worker March and how they should relate to it. Well, out of that, the AFL-CIO not only came out against the march, but threatened any local they thought they could get away with threatening and withdrawing funds from any labor council that voted to support the march. So this is not, we're not just talking about some legislative, you know, they just kind of changed their position legislatively. This is active anti-working class action that the Democrats are involved in.
Now, here we have a raggedy Republican outline a number of raggedy Democrats that have not raised objections in Ohio. And then as he goes through a list that basically says that these Democrats are down with us and think that the whole electoral thing went okay in Ohio, Negro John Conyers steps in, or wait, maybe I should say taps in. This is what I'm saying, check it out.
Base, outrageous acts to take place. No Democratic state chairman in our state is challenged, to my knowledge, the count or the outcome in any county. His name is Danny White. The Democratic chairman no county that I know of has challenged either the count or the outcome in any county. The Democratic Board of Election members have not challenged the count or the outcome of any county. This should be voted down.
Mr. Speaker.
Gentleman from Michigan. 5 minutes.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to include in my statement
the staff report of the House Judiciary Committee Democratic staff entitled Preserving Democracy, What Went Wrong in Ohio.
Without objection.
Thank you. I yield to the gentleman from Missouri, Lacey Clay, for a unanimous consent request.
It's cold, man.
Gentleman from Missouri.
Thank the gentleman from Michigan for yielding. I ask unanimous consent to insert my remarks into the record.
Without objection.
Members of the House, we are here today not as partisans for one presidential candidate or another, but because we want to do our duty under the Constitution to protect our democracy. We're here because the inner city voter in Franklin County who waited 10 hours in the pouring rain while suburban voters in the same county had no wait because election officials decided to reallocate voting machines from Columbus to the suburbs. We're here because of the Hispanic voter in Hamilton County who also stood in line for hours but was directed to the wrong voting table and had their ballot thrown out, his ballot thrown out because of a decision by the Secretary of State of Ohio to throw out ballots cast at the right polling place, but the wrong precinct. We're here because of the elderly voter in Lucas County who requested an absentee ballot that never showed up and was refused a provisional ballot because of another partisan decision by the Secretary of State of Ohio. We're here because of the new voter in Delaware County whose registration form was thrown out because it did not meet the paperweight requirements set forth by the Secretary of State. We're here because of the African-American voter in Summit County who targeted with an unlawful voter challenge because of her race and because she refused to answer a certified letter from the chairman of the Republican Party. Mr. Speaker, how much time do I have remaining, please?
Gentleman has 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Thank you. I'm going to yield very shortly to the distinguished gentleman from Vermont for the balance of my time. Most of all, we're here because not a single election official in Ohio has given us any explanation for the massive and widespread irregularity in the state. No explanation for the machine in Mahoning County that recorded carry votes for Bush. No explanation of the improper purging in Cuyahoga County. No explanation for the lockdown in Warren County. No explanation for the 99% turnout in Miami County. No explanation for machine tampering in Hocking County. Read on our webpage 101 pages of great staff work that takes this out of semantics of partisanship, and I appeal to every member of this body to who has sustained this objection, and I'm proud to yield to the distinguished gentleman from Vermont, Mr. Bernie Sanders, for the remainder of my time.
Gentleman from Vermont is recognized.
Speaker, how much time do I have?
You have 59 seconds.
Thank you. I thank the distinguished gentleman from Michigan for yielding. I agree with John Kerry. I think George W. Bush won Ohio. But I agree with millions of American citizens that no American should have to wait 4 hours to cast a vote. I agree with tens of millions of Americans who are very worried that when they cast the ballot on an electronic voting machine, that there is no paper trail to record that vote in the event of a recount. What today is about is to demand that the federal government begin to move forward to guarantee that every voter in America feels secure and confident that all of the votes cast in this country are counted accurately and that all of our voters
are treated with respect and dignity. That is what democracy is about, and that is what we are fighting
time
for.
Expired.
Time has expired, all right. This is kind of sickening, because when you hear Conyers talk about, the issues going on, the Democratic Party didn't do anything to organize the masses of those disenfranchised people, because they don't want them energized and getting out of control. Carries off in the backwoods fishing. Now, Conyers is right about all this stuff about there's been no explanation about machine tampering and improper perjuring and all of that, but there doesn't have to be, because you guys aren't doing it. You weren't really challenging them. You were just there sniveling and stuff. So is this all a charade that was going on? And what's so pathetic is this type of stuff happened 4 years ago. Now, also, for all you little weak liberals and pacifists and progressives out there, your own philosophy also plays into this. Even some of, or actually many of your icons and stuff. When you take, that there's no real strong historical type of analysis either on a lot of these issues. Is this whole Gumpify process just like the Democrats, your trainers? Like, if you look at someone like Gandhi, who's often thrown out there as the icon of, pacifist strategy and so on and so forth. In reality, Gandhi, just like the myth that the Democratic Party is for the working people and all of that, Gandhi's loyalties were always with the British Empire. He was a hardcore racist against Africans. One time when Gandhi got thrown off a train, he was so furious about it, because the merchant caste of Indians that he was, that he's a part of, were treated on the same par with the local Africans. June 2nd, 1906, he commented in the Indian Opinion that, quote, "Thanks to the court decision, only clean Indians," meaning upper-class Hindu Indians, "or colored people other than Kaffirs," which is a derogatory term towards blacks, "can travel in the trains." So this was his mentality. During the Kaffir Wars, quote-unquote, in South Africa, he was a regular Ganja Din. That means he volunteered to organize brigades of Indians to put down the Zulu uprising. Now, here's a pacifist organizing to put down the particular Zulu uprisings. And September 26, 1896, this is what he said about African people. Well, quote, "Ours is one continued struggle sought to be inflicted upon us by the Europeans, who desire to degrade us to the level of the raw Kaffir, whose occupation is hunting and whose sole ambition is to collect a certain number of cattle to buy a wife and then pass his life in indolence and nakedness." This was his whole mentality. Once again, in the Indian Opinion, this was in March 18, 1905, he wrote that Clause 200 makes provisions for registrations of persons belonging to uncivilized races, meaning the local Africans, residents and employed with the boroughs. Now, to show you the contradiction about his whole image as being a pacifist, Gandhi, when the issue erupted in 1899, the Anglo-Boer War, Gandhi, in spite of his whole concept of being this so-called pacifist, actually formed an ambulance unit in support of the British forces. He was extremely earnest about taking up arms and laying down his life for his beloved queen. You're talking about the British. He led his men onto the battlefield and received a war medal. Gandhi joined in the orgy of Zulu slaughter when the Bambetta Rebellion broke out. Now, within the whole liberal pacifist mythology, Gandhi has and is supposed to exemplify the principles of nonviolence, and he's supposed to be someone who symbolizes how you make social change. When in actuality, he was a pro-colonialist. He was a racist. He was the same type of contradictory principles that the Democratic Party stands for. And unfortunately, the same type of people who fall for the Democratic Party are the same type who fall for these false idols like Gandhi, who are supposed to present an image that is something contradictory. Completely contradictory to what they truly stand for. Now, to finish this off, this is the last word. After Sanders got through yelping, his Republican counterpart countered, and this is what his counterpart said. Check this out.
Purpose of the distinguished whip from Missouri, rise.
I rise to it for 5 minutes.
Without objection, gentlemen's recognized for 5 minutes.
Listen to my friend from Vermont make his remarks. I assume that means that he'll be voting with me to accept the results from Ohio, since he agrees that the president won. That's just been verified for me.
And that says it in a nutshell. You know, before Bernie Sanders said that he agrees that Boy George won. So he was just putting on a show, and all the Republican did was throw it back out there. So in reality, whoever wins, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, we lose, because they represent something that is counter-opposed to our basic human rights. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just about going to wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that whether you have a Democratic philosophy, Republican philosophy, is basically locked up in a penitentiary philosophy. What we need is a revolutionary slave revolt philosophy. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.